but something happened during those pre-dawn hours. Other than music, I heard nothing else. No moaning from other rooms or footsteps of nurses in the hallway. I felt totally isolated from the world around me. Then, the dam broke. Tears slid down my cheeks, and I couldn't wipe them away. I didn't even want to try. They just flowed. The tears wouldn't stop, and I cried as I had never wept before. I'm not sure, but I think the crying lasted for about an hour. Slowly, the sobbing subsided. Calmness swept over me, and I lay relaxed and very much at peace. That's when I realized another miracle had taken place. My depression had lifted, vanished. I had been healed. Again. Stark reminders from some simple songs had changed me. The Imperials reminded me that Satan is a liar. He wants to steal our joy and replace it with hopelessness. When we're up against a struggle and we think we can't keep going, we can change that by praising God. Our chains will fall from us. Meese encouraged me by reminding me of the real reason we have for fully living this life. It's to give everything we have to God, even the heartbreaks and pain. God is our reason to live. That morning, I determined to get on with living the rest of my life, no matter what. I made that decision with no psychiatric help, no drugs, and no counseling. As I listened to those two songs, God had healed me. The despair lifted. My mental chains had broken. I also knew that nothing I had gone through or would endure was as horrific as what Jesus suffered. I'm not trying to imply that I'm against psychological help. Before and since my accident, I have sent many people for counseling. But because I wasn't open to help of any kind, God healed me in a dramatic and unexplainable way. As I lay there, my attitude changed. I had no idea when my physical pain would end or how long I'd have to wear the Elizaroff frame, but I knew Jesus Christ was with me. I still didn't understand why God had sent me back to live with all this agony, but that no longer mattered. Now I was free. He had healed my mind. My body would mend slowly, but I had experienced the major victory. Never again would depression afflict me. It was just one more miracle from heaven. Chapter 11. Back to Church. 1 Peter 5:6-7. So humble yourselves under the mighty power of God, and in His good time He will honor you. Give all your worries and cares to God, for He cares about what happens to you. 1 Peter 5:6. Some people who have known me for a long time see me as some kind of courageous figure. I certainly haven't seen myself that way, not for an instant, because I know too much about the real me. I also know how little I did to get through my ordeal. Despite my own perceptions, friends and church members say they received encouragement by watching me as I progressed from a totally helpless state and gradually moved toward a fairly normal lifestyle. A number of individuals have said to me in the midst of their own difficult times, "If you could go through all you endured, I can get through this." I'm glad they've been heartened by my example, but I've had a great deal of difficulty accepting myself as a source of inspiration and courage. I don't know how to cope with their admiration and praise because I didn't do anything. I wanted to die. How uplifting can that be? Would people tell me how inspiring I've been, I don't argue with him, of course, but I remember all too well the time David Gentiles told me that he and others would pray me back to health. I lived because others wouldn't let me die. Those praying friends are the ones who deserve the admiration. Most of the time when people have that if-you-can-do-it attitude, I nod, acknowledging what they're saying, and add, I'm just doing the best I can. And really, that's all I did during the worst days. Sometimes the best I can was nothing but to endure. Even when I struggled with depression, it was still the best I could do. Maybe that's what God honors. I don't know. By nature, I'm a determined individual, which I admit can sometimes be a first cousin to stubbornness. Yet many times I felt terribly alone and was convinced that no one else understood. And I still think that's true. When our pain becomes intense and endures for weeks without relief, no one else really knows. I'm not sure it's worthwhile for them to know what it's like. They care. That's what I think is important. After I came home from the hospital in the middle of May, I still had to sleep in a hospital bed until February 1990, a total of 13 months. Even after sleeping in my own house, I had setbacks of various kinds or developed infections. Back to the hospital I'd go, and some of those trips, especially in the early days, were for life-threatening infections. Sometimes I'd stay 2 weeks and other times three. On most occasions, Eva drove me there, but I always came home in an ambulance. After they initially released me from the hospital, church members kept telling me how good I looked considering all that's happened. No one actually said the words, but I imagined them saying, "We're praying for Don. We can't believe how well it turned out. We asked for him to live, and we asked for him to be better." That is, I was a pitiful mess. But I was alive, and that's what they had asked for. My twin sons, Joe and Christopher, were only 8 at the time of the accident, and our daughter, Nicole, was 12. One of the things that hurt me most during my recovery was the sense of pain my children had to cope with. They didn't say a great deal, but I knew how they felt. This is a handmade card from my son Joe, written to me in February 1989 while living with his grandparents. I didn't correct the spelling. "Hi, Dad. You are the best. I love you, and I hope you like the cards. I wish this never happened. I love you, Dad. Joe." Months later, when I finally came home, most afternoons, Joe's twin, Chris, came in from school into the large living room where my bed was. Without saying a word, Chris would walk over and lay his head on my chest. I don't know how long his head lay there, probably not more than a full minute. He never said a word. He didn't need to. That simple gesture was enough. I felt so loved by my son. After a minute or so, Chris would go into his room, get out of his school clothes, change into his play clothes, and then go outside and play. That's the way he greeted me almost every day. I know it was hard on him, really hard on him, and he expressed his grief in the only way he knew how. Just 6 months after the accident, I was able to participate in a very special moment for Nicole. Southern Baptists have mission organizations for young people. The most well-known are the Royal Ambassadors for Boys and Girls in Action, or GAs, and Acteens for Girls. As soon as she was old enough, Nicole participated in GAs and Acteens. She fulfilled all the requirements, such as scripture memorization, various service projects, and mission trips. When she was 14, she learned she would be awarded the honor of Queen with Scepter at a coronation ceremony at South Park Baptist Church in June 1989. This award is the pinnacle of Acteen participation and is presented during a church ceremony. Her receiving the award was a tribute to her own utter determination. During the time she threw herself into those activities, she wasn't able to live at home. Our friends, Susan and Stan Malden, had opened their home to her, and she lived with them. Nicole received no emotional or physical support from me because I was barely surviving in the hospital. She received little support from her mother because Eva's life consisted of leaving school every afternoon and rushing to the hospital, where she stayed with me until she went home to bed. The challenges made us all the more proud of Nicole. One of the traditions associated with the coronation is that the fathers escort their daughters down the aisle. Brothers, if the girls have any, follow and carry the crown and scepter. Because of the timing of South Park's annual coronation, there was great doubt about my being able to be present, much less escort her down the aisle. I'm grateful that the doctors discharged me from the hospital in time to be present for the coronation. I really wanted to be there. This wasn't her wedding, but it was the biggest thing so far in her young life, and I wanted to share the moment with her. I was in a wheelchair, and Nicole held my arm as I rolled down the aisle. Chris and Joe walked behind us, carrying her crown and scepter on pillows. They also helped roll my chair down the aisle. I wore a suit coat and tie, my first time since the accident, along with my warm-ups split down the side to allow for my Elizaroff. Not only was Nicole absolutely elated that her daddy could be present for her extremely important occasion, she was thrilled that her father could walk her down the aisle. Tears filled my eyes as I maneuvered down the aisle. I heard others sniffling, but I also knew that we wept tears of joy over this wonderful moment in Nicole's life. The doctors sent me home initially, I believe, because they thought I'd recover faster in an environment with family around me. It may also have cost a lot less for me to be home. I'm not sure. But I was glad to be out of the hospital. Insurance didn't pay for any of my treatment. The bill was covered at first by workman's compensation and ultimately the state of Texas, because a federal court found them at fault. Still, being in my own home wasn't much easier for me or my family, especially Eva. Every day someone had to give me shots. I had to have physical therapy treatments, all done to me and for me at home. Our living room looked like a hospital room. I did feel better about being out of that sterile environment. Just being around familiar things lifted my spirit. I enjoyed being able to look out the window at my neighborhood or having people drop in to see me who didn't wear white uniforms. The medical team sent my bed and a trapeze contraption, just like what I used at the hospital. Nurses visited every day. Physical therapists came every other day. Some of the sweetest memories I have are of the kind people who simply spent each day with me while Eva went back to work. When church members heard that she had to return to teaching or lose her job, they decided to do what they could. Jenny Foster, the senior pastor's wife, organized a group of people to stay with me each day. Jenny organized what she laughingly called the Don Patrol, mostly women from the church along with a few retired men. It was about 7 hours from the time Eva left in the morning until she returned. My sleeping habits depended on when I could fight the pain no more and would pass out. But gradually, a pattern began to emerge. I would generally go to sleep about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and wake up around 10. The Dawn Patrol arrived about 9 o'clock while I was still asleep. They either prepared lunch for me or brought it with them. Often I would awake to find a charming woman knitting at the end of my bed. Or perhaps an older man would be reading the Houston Chronicle. He'd lower the newspaper and grin at me. "Good morning. Do you need anything?" The parade of sweet faces changed every day. Although the volunteers were different, the goals remained the same. Take care of Don and keep him company. As I lay in bed day after day, I realized how much others had done for us. While I was still hospitalized, friends from the Alvin Church had packed up our furniture and moved us to a new house, where I could be on the ground level with no stairs to worry about. During the day, I would look through the patio window from my hospital room. Often I spotted high schoolers Brandon and Matt Mueller and their buddy Chris Alston mowing our lawn. Chris arranged to borrow our van one night and surprise me by taking me to a movie. I don't even remember what the movie was, but I will never forget his thoughtfulness. Once, when our fence blew down during a windstorm, it was back up before we could call anyone to help. Only God knows all the kindnesses shown to us during my recovery. As I began to stir in my bed each morning, my keeper would get up and bring me a toothbrush and a pan to brush my teeth and wash my face. I'd have a glass of juice held to my lips and later a huge lunch ready for me. After feeding me, washing me, and making sure I was comfortable as my physical condition would allow, they all asked the same question: "Is there anything else I can get for you before I leave?" My answer was always the same: "No thanks." I would muster what I hoped was my best smile. Probably wasn't, but they always smiled back. "It's all right. I'll be fine." The capacity for sacrifice and service that human beings have for one another knows no bounds. With all our faults, surely God must have meant that the kindnesses shown to me during my injury and recovery were paramount examples of us being created in His image. Within an hour or so after my daily Dawn Patrol angel quietly exited, the door would open and Eva would enter from a long day at school. She always gave me a big smile and kissed me. "Are you all right?" she would ask. "I'm fine," I would say, meaning it. I couldn't put my feelings into words then, but the assurance that I had been visited by an angel from the Dawn Patrol caused my spirit to soar. For months after I came home, good-hearted members of the Dawn Patrol transported me back and forth for water therapy, which was done near our home in Alvin. During the first 13 months, if I wasn't inside the hospital, I was lying in the hospital bed at the house. For months, I probably wasn't out of the bed more than 5 minutes a day except for therapy. Some days, I didn't even get out of the bed. The worst part is that once I was in the hospital bed, I was completely incapacitated. I couldn't get up or do anything for myself. Without the help of the therapist, I never would have sat up or been able to move on my own again. Slowly, gradually, I learned to walk again. The first day I got out of bed on my own, I took 3 steps. I slumped back onto the bed, feeling a wave of exhaustion overwhelm me. But I smiled. I had walked. 3 steps sounds like so little, and yet I felt a powerful sense of accomplishment. So much of recovery from a trauma of this magnitude has a striking similarity to training a child in infancy. I had been helpless for such a long time that when I could finally go to the bathroom by myself, it felt like a remarkable accomplishment. Walking again was a stark reminder of what we all take for granted every day as we talk, move, and live. When I could walk again, it was not only a singular accomplishment, but a tribute to hundreds of medical people who worked tirelessly to help me. It was also a tribute to my friends and family who believed in me, although they couldn't have known just how difficult it would be for me to put one foot in front of the other. While I suppose walking represented a certain triumph of will, it also meant I could begin to live in relative normalcy. I often thought of that last night at Trinity Pines when J.V. Thomas and I took our walk around the camp. That was my last normal walk ever. For many months, no one was sure I'd ever walk again. For a long time, taking just 3 shaky steps seemed like climbing Mount Everest. "I did it!" I shouted to the silent room. "I walked. I walked." Taking those first steps at home on my own remains one of the best memories of my recovery. Those few steps convinced me that I was getting better. Now I had goals to work toward. I had gone through the worst part of the recovery. I knew I would continue to improve. Each day, I took a few more steps. By the end of the week, I had made a complete circle of the living room. When Eva came home and watched me demonstrate my daily progress, her smile made me feel as if I'd won a marathon. She reacted with absolute joyful delight the afternoon I showed her that I could walk throughout the house all by myself. A week after I came home from the hospital, I had decided I wanted to go to church on a Sunday morning. In retrospect, it was premature, but I felt a burning desire to be back with people I loved and to worship with them. With the help of a small group, we planned for them to help me get there. In case I couldn't make it, we didn't want to disappoint anybody, so we decided not to announce it to the congregation. By then, I could sit in a wheelchair, as long as someone was there to lift me out of bed and into it, but I still couldn't stand up. 6 friends from church came to our house and took the seats out of one of the church vans. At church, they had constructed a ramp so they could roll me up to its doors. I kept thinking of all the work I had laid on them, and several times I started to apologize, but they assured me it was their pleasure. Then I remembered Jay's words. My family and friends saw me the first day of the accident. I never saw what I looked like. They endured the shock and the fear. They had to come to grips with the possibility of my death or my long-term disability. In some respects, this ordeal was more difficult for my family and friends than it was for me. They loved being able to help me. In a way, this was part of their own recovery, and they were glad to be able to do something special for me. Yet, as much as I wanted to attend the worship service that morning, it was still hard to let them do everything for me. I felt totally helpless and absolutely dependent on them. As I realized that once again, I smiled. "Thank you," I said, and then allowed them to take care of me. They carefully put me in the van, drove me to church, and pulled up to the side door. When one of the men in the van opened the door, church members on their way into the sanctuary saw me. "Look, it's Pastor Don," someone yelled. I heard cheering and clapping as people stood around and made way for the men to wheel me up the ramp. Just then, everything turned chaotic. People rushed toward me. Several cheered. It seemed as if everyone wanted to touch me or shake my hand. I could hardly believe the fuss they made over me. Finally, someone wheeled me inside and stopped my chair in front of the platform near the church organ. It wasn't possible to lift me up. By then, the entire congregation had become aware that I was in front of the sanctuary. I smiled as I thought, it's only taken me 5 months to get from the conference at Trinity Pines back to church. I may be slow, but I'm faithful. Just then, someone whispered in my ear, "We want you to say something to the congregation." He got behind me and steered me toward the center of the sanctuary, right in front of the pulpit. By then, exhaustion had begun to seep in. It had probably nagged me all along, but I had been so determined to get back to church, I refused to admit how tired I felt. I had been out of bed more than 2 hours. That was the longest time I had been out of bed up to that point, and also the longest time I had spent in a wheelchair. In that moment, I realized I had been foolish in wanting to come, because I wasn't up to the physical demands on my body. My stubbornness had overestimated my endurance. Perhaps just as bad, I became completely overwhelmed at the congregation's loving response. I didn't know if I could speak. What can I say after all those weeks of absence and all I'd been through? While I was still trying to figure that out, someone thrust a microphone in my hand. As I clutched it, I kept thinking, "You people really have no idea how little I contributed to my recovery. You see it as a triumph. I see it merely as survival." Just then, spontaneous applause broke out. I had expected them to be glad to see me. I had not been prepared for the avalanche of praise to God. Every person in that building stood, and the applause began, and it kept on for a long time. I finally waved them to stop. As I stared at them, I felt guilty about their applause and excitement. I couldn't believe those people were applauding me. If they only knew, I thought. If they only knew. Then God spoke to me. This was one of the few times in my life when I heard a very clear voice inside my head. "They're not applauding for you." Just those words. But it made a difference, and I could speak. Finally, I had it straight. They were giving thanks to God for what He had done for me. God had brought me back from death to life once again. I relaxed. This was a moment to glorify God. This wasn't praise for me. I still had to wait for what seemed like a long time until the applause ceased. I spoke only four words. Anyone who was there that glorious day can tell you what they were. "You prayed, I'm here." The congregation erupted in spontaneous applause. If I had said anything else, I'm sure they wouldn't have heard it anyway. I couldn't say it, but I believed then, and still do, that I survived only because a number of people wanted me to. They were relentless, passionate, and desperate, and they believed God would hear them. People prayed for me who had never seriously prayed before. Some who hadn't uttered a word of petition in years cried out to God to spare me. My experience had brought people to their knees, and many of them had changed in the process of praying for me to live. When I did live, those same people, especially those who hadn't been in the habit of praying, said the experience revolutionized their lives. In some instances, individuals I had never met, from Cottonwood, Arizona to Buffalo, New York, heard my story second, third, and fourth hand. Over the next 3 years, people would approach me and say, "I saw you on a video interview. You're the man. I prayed for you." Or they heard one of the audio tapes of my testimony distributed by my church and would say, "You just don't know what it means. God heard our prayers, and we're so happy you lived." To some individuals, I'm not really a person, but a symbol. For them, I represent answered prayer. They may remember my ministry at South Park Church or even some of the messages I preached, but what they remember most is that they sought God's face in deep, sincere, earnest prayer. They pleaded for me to survive, and I did. I don't know what to make of it, except to say that this is something outside of and beyond me. I think I'm also a human response to some of the questions people wanted answered. Since I began to tell others about my experience in heaven, I can't begin to count the people who have come to me and asked such questions as, "Is heaven real? What is heaven really like?" Or they'll ask specific questions about the praise or the streets of gold. Someone seems to always mention a recent departed loved one. Just to know that I've been there and come back to earth and am able to talk to them seems to bring deep comfort to many. Sometimes it amazes me. Others look at the marks of my body even today and say, "You're a miracle because of all you went through. You're a walking miracle." Chapter 12, Opening Up. 2 Corinthians 5, 1-4. For we know that when this earthly tent we live in is taken down, when we die and leave these bodies, we will have a home in heaven, an eternal body made for us by God Himself and not by human hands. We grow weary in our present bodies, and we long for a day when we will be put in our heavenly bodies like new clothing. For we will not be spirits without bodies, but we will put on new heavenly bodies. Our dying bodies make us groan and sigh, but it's not that we want to die and have no bodies at all. We want to slip into our new bodies, so that these dying bodies will be swallowed up by everlasting life. 2 Corinthians 5, 1-4. God used my closest friend, David Gentiles, to keep me alive, and I'm grateful. He also used David again in my life nearly 2 years after the accident. Until then, I had never talked to anyone about my heavenly experience. In a general sense, I had talked to Eva, but I always closed off the conversation before she asked questions. She tacitly understood that part of my experience was off-limits. To her credit, she never pressured me to say anything more. It wasn't that I wanted to withhold anything from Eva. I just couldn't talk about the experience. At times, I felt that it had been too sacred, and that to try to explain it would diminish the incident. Nearly a year and a half after my release from the hospital, David came to the Houston area for a discipleship weekend. He used that as an excuse to come to my house and spend time with me. When the two of us were alone, I had a flashback to the time when I had been lying in the ICU and had told him that I couldn't go on. That's when he told me that he would pray me through. We talked about that day, and I thanked him again for his friendship and relentless commitment to prayer. "How are you feeling now?" he asked. "I'm in pain." I tried to laugh and added, "I'm always in pain, but that's not the worst part for me right now." He leaned closer. "What is the worst part?" "I just don't know where I'm going. I lack any clear direction about my future." David listened as I talked about things I would like to do, the things I couldn't physically do, and how I wasn't sure that God wanted me to continue at South Park. I felt loved and needed there, but I wasn't sure that was where I should be. He listened for a long time, then asked gently, "What did you learn from your accident and recovery experience?" For 3 or 4 minutes, I shared several things, especially about letting other people inside and allowing them to help me. Then I said, "But in the midst of all this suffering and despondency, I have learned that heaven is real." He raised his eyebrows. "What do you mean by that?" Slowly, hesitantly, I shared a little, very little, about my brief visit to heaven. "Tell me more," he said. And I didn't hear it as prying. He was my friend and wanted to know. I also sensed that I could speak about heaven to David and that, as much as any human being was able, he would understand. "I died in that accident. The next moment, I stood in heaven," I said. He leaned forward, and although he waited silently for me to continue, I saw the excitement in his eyes. The more I shared, the more animated he became. In retrospect, I believe David's exuberance was a combination of my personal confirmation of heaven's reality and his relief in knowing something good had come out of my long nightmare. After I had shared my experience in heaven, he said nothing, and a peaceful silence filled the room. Our friendship was such that we didn't have to fill the gap with words. David finally nodded and asked, "Why haven't you talked about this before?" I have two very good reasons. Number one, if I go around talking about having been in heaven, people will think I'm nuts. "Why would you think that? I heard you, and I didn't." "Number two," I said, interrupting him, "I don't want to go over that experience again. It's just too personal, too special. This is something I haven't even processed enough to understand it myself. It's not that I don't want to share it, but I don't think I can." "Why do you think you experienced heaven if you're not supposed to share it?" "I don't have an answer for that question." "Why?" "I'll tell you a better question I've asked myself. Why did I experience it and have it taken away from me? What was that all about?" Months of pent-up anger burst forth and all the interior pain spewed out. "Okay, why did I have to go through this? I saw the glory and the beauty, the most powerful, overwhelming experiences in my life, and then I had to come back. Why? For this?" I pointed to my arm and leg. "Listen, I was in an accident that took my life. Immediately, I went to heaven, and it was greater and more wonderful than anything I ever imagined. I had a magnificent taste of heaven. And then I was pulled back to this life again. My body is a mess. I'm constantly in pain. I'll never be healthy or strong again. I'm still processing this because frankly, it all seems cruel to me." David stared at me and asked again, "Why do you think you experienced it if you're not supposed to share it?" "Like I said, I don't have an answer for that question." "Is it possible that God took you to heaven and brought you back for you to share what happened to you? Don't you realize what a powerful encouragement you can be to others?" His words shocked me. I had been so focused on myself, I hadn't thought about anyone else. I broke down as I tried to relate to him how I felt and to explain it to myself. I cried in his presence, and I knew it was all right. For perhaps 20 minutes, we discussed it. David nudged me, and although I knew he was right, it still wasn't easy for me to share my experience. Finally, David said, "I want you to make a covenant with me." "What kind of covenant?" "Simple. Pick two people you trust. Just tell them a little of your experience and gauge their response." He went on to explain that if they thought I was crazy or that I had hallucinated, then I would never have to speak about it again. "But if they rejoice with you," he said, "and if they urge you to tell them more, I want you to take this as a sign that God wants you to talk about those 90 minutes you spent in heaven." After considering the matter carefully, I covenanted with him. "I can do that much." "When?" "I promise to do it soon." "Very soon, right?" "Okay. I promise I won't put it off." David prayed for me, and as I listened to him speak, the certainty came over me. It was no longer a choice. I had to speak out, but I would do it in my way. First, I decided on those I could trust with my holy secret. Once I had narrowed it down to a handful, I still took a cautious approach. I made sure it was a one-on-one conversation. I'd wait until the matter of my health came up, and it always did, and then I'd say something simple such as, "You know, I died that day, and I woke up in heaven. The reaction was the same each time. "Tell me more." They didn't always say those words, but that's what they wanted. I could see their eyes widen, and they wanted to know more. As I shared a little more, no one questioned my sanity. No one told me I had hallucinated. "You have to tell people about this," one of them said. "That experience wasn't just for you," another friend said. "It's for us as well. It's for me." As I listened to each one over the next 2 weeks, I realized I was right back where I had been in the hospital the time Jay had rebuked me. That time I wouldn't let anyone help me, and it was selfish. This time I wouldn't share what had happened to me, and it was also selfish. "Okay, I'll talk about it," I vowed to myself. Since virtually everyone already knew about my tragic auto accident, I used the occasion as a natural catalyst to speak about my time in heaven, cautiously at first. As people responded with overwhelming support, I became more open and less careful about the people with whom I shared my story. I wanted to make it clear, even though I knew it was what I was supposed to do, it wasn't easy for me. Even now, years later, it's just against my nature to talk deeply and personally about things in my life. Today, I only discuss my glimpse of heaven when someone asks, and then only because I feel that person really wants to know. Otherwise, I still wouldn't talk about it. That's part of the reason it's taken me so many years to write this book. I didn't want my experience in heaven and my return to earth to be my sole reason for being alive. On the contrary, it was such an extraordinary personal and intimate experience that going back over it repeatedly isn't something I felt comfortable doing. I talk about my experience both publicly and to individuals. I'm writing about what happened because my story seems to mean so much to people for many different reasons. For example, when I speak to any large crowd, at least one person will be present who has recently lost a loved one and needs assurance of that person's destination. When I finish speaking, it still amazes me to see how quickly the lines form of those who want to talk to me. They come with tears in their eyes and grief written all over their faces. I feel so grateful that I can offer them peace and assurance. I've accepted that my words do bring comfort, but it was never something I thought about doing. If it hadn't been for David Gentile's pushing me, I'm sure that even to this day, I wouldn't have told anyone. I'm also grateful for his urging me, because I've seen the effect not only in worship services, but also when I have conducted funerals. In fact, my experience has changed many things about the way I look at life. I've changed the way I do funerals. Now I can speak authoritatively about heaven from first-hand knowledge. Besides my own miraculous experience, four things stand out from my heavenly journey. First, I'm thoroughly convinced that God answers prayer. Answered prayer is why I'm still alive. Second, I have an unquestionable belief that God still is in the miracle business. Too many people read about the supernatural in the Bible and think that's the way it was in biblical times. I'm convinced that God continues to do the more than ordinary. Every day, I thank God that I'm a living, walking, talking miracle. Third, I want as many people as possible to go to heaven. I've always believed Christian theology that declares heaven is real and a place for God's people. Since my own experience of having been there, I've felt a stronger sense of responsibility to make the way absolutely clear. Not only do I want people to go to heaven, I now feel an urgency about helping them open their lives so they can be assured that that's where they'll go when they die. I've actually thought about people who get killed on highways. In evangelistic services, some have used such stories as a scare tactic to manipulate people into making commitments to Jesus Christ. Because of my experience, I see such accidents as definite possibilities of death at any moment in our lives. I don't want to see others die without Jesus Christ. Finally, one time, Dick Onorecker and I talked about this urgency. He understood why I felt that way. Then I told him, "Again, Dick, I want to say thank you for saving my life. I obviously can't thank you enough for your faithfulness in obeying God that rainy day." "It was what anybody would have done," he said. And then he started crying. I didn't mean to upset you," I said, feeling bad that I had said something to make him cry like that. "That's the last thing on earth I ever wanted to do. That's not what I'm crying about." Several minutes lapsed before he finally pulled himself back together again. "What were you crying about?" I asked. I was thinking that I came upon the scene of the accident, and I asked the officer if I could pray for you, and I thought of it as just something any Christian would do. Although he said you were dead, I just knew I had to pray for you. I could only think that you were hurt, and I wanted to make you feel better. I didn't do anything unusual. "But you did. When the officer told you I was already dead, listen to me, Don. If you saw a little kid run out in the street, you'd dash out there and try to save the child's life. Human nature is like that. We try to preserve life, and I will do that any time I get the opportunity. So would you." We were sitting in the restaurant, and he paused to look around. "Yet here we are, sitting in this place, surrounded by people, many of whom are probably lost and going to hell, and we won't say a word about how they can have eternal life. Something is wrong with us." "You're absolutely right," I said. "We are willing to save someone in a visible crisis, but a lot of folks are in a spiritual crisis, and we don't say a word about how they can get out of it. That's why I was crying. I've been convicted about my silence, my fear of speaking to people, my reluctance to speak up." Dick said then, and again later, that hearing my experience and his role in my coming back to earth had set him free. After that, he felt a boldness to talk about Jesus Christ that he hadn't had before. Chapter 13, The Clasping Hand. Deuteronomy 10:21. "He is your God, the one who is worthy of your praise, the one who has done mighty miracles that you yourself have seen." Deuteronomy 10:21. I was privileged to share my story in Dick's church, Klein First Baptist, a little more than a year after the accident. His wife, Anita, was there, and so was my own family. Because I still wore leg braces, two people had to help me walk up on the platform. I told everyone about the accident and about Dick's part in bringing me back. I believe I'm alive today because Dick prayed me back to earth, I said. In my first moments of consciousness, two things stand out. First, I was singing, "What a Friend We Have in Jesus." The second was that Dick's hand gripped mine and held it tight. After the morning service, many of us went to lunch together at a Chinese restaurant. Anita sat across from me. I remember sipping my wonton soup and having a delightful time with the church members. When there was a lull in the conversation, Anita leaned across the table and said in a low voice, "I appreciated everything you said this morning. Thank you. There's just one thing I need to correct about what you said in your message." "Really?" Her words shocked me. I tried to be as accurate as possible in everything I said. I certainly didn't intend to exaggerate anything. What did I say that was incorrect? "You were talking about Dick getting into the car with you. Then you said he prayed for you while he was holding your hand." "Yes, I remember that part very distinctly. I have a number of memory gaps, and most of the things I don't remember. That morning, I had readily admitted that some of the information I gave came secondhand. The one thing that's totally clear was Dick being in the car and praying with me. That's true. He did get in the car and pray with you. She leaned closer. But, Don, he never held your hand. I distinctly remember holding his hand. That didn't happen. It was physically impossible. But I remember that so clearly. It was one of the most vivid... Think about it. Dick leaned over from the rear of the trunk over the back seat and put his hand on your shoulder and touched you. You were facing forward, and your left arm was barely hanging together. Yes, that's true. Dick said you were slumped over on the seat toward the passenger side. I closed my eyes, visualizing what she had just said. I nodded. Your right hand was on the floor of the passenger side of the car. Although the tarp covered the car, there was enough light for him to see your hand down there. There was no way Dick could have reached your right hand. But I sputtered. Someone was holding your hand. But it wasn't Dick. If it wasn't Dick, who was it? She smiled and said, I think you know. I put down my spoon and stared at her for several seconds. I had no doubt whatsoever that someone had held my hand. Then I understood. Yes, I think I know too. Immediately I thought of the verse in Hebrews about entertaining angels unaware. As I pondered for a moment, I also remembered other incidents where there was nothing but a spiritual explanation. For instance, many times in the hospital room, in the middle of the night, I would be at my worst. I never saw or heard anyone, but I felt a presence, something, someone sustaining and encouraging me. That also was something I hadn't talked about. I couldn't explain it, so I assumed others wouldn't understand. This was another miracle, and I wouldn't have known about it if Anita hadn't corrected me. 5 years after the accident, Dick and I both appeared on Pat Robertson's 700 Club. A camera crew came to Texas to reenact the accident and then asked me to talk about my visit to Heaven's Gate. The 700 Club aired that segment many times over the next 2 years. In one of life's great ironic twists, Dick died of a heart attack in 2001. I confess that I was saddened to hear of his passing, but delighted that he is in glory. Dick saved my life, and God took him to heaven first. I was glad he heard me share my journey to heaven before he made his own trip. Since that experience with Anita, a little more than a year after my accident, I've been more convinced than ever that God brought me back to this earth for a purpose. The angel gripping my hand was God's way of sustaining me and letting me know that he would not let go of me no matter how hard things became. I may not feel that hand each day, but I know it's there. Chapter 14, The New Normal. Jeremiah 30:17. I will give you back your health and heal your wounds, says the Lord. Now you are called an outcast, Jerusalem, for whom nobody cares. Jeremiah 30:17. Some things happen to us from which we'd never recover, and they disrupt the normalcy of our lives. That's how life is. Human nature has a tendency to try to reconstruct old ways and pick up where we left off. If we're wise, we won't continue to go back to the way things were. We can't, anyway. We must instead forget the old standard and accept a new normal. I wasted a lot of time thinking about how I used to be healthy and had no physical limitations. In my mind, I'd reconstruct how life ought to be. But in reality, I knew my life would never be the same. I had to adjust and accept my physical limits as part of my new normal. As a child, I'd sit on a big brown rug in my great-grandparents' living room and listen to them talk about the good old days. After hearing several stories, I thought, those days weren't that good. At least their recollections they shared didn't seem so great. Maybe for them they were truly the good old days, or perhaps they forgot the negative parts of those days. At some points in our lives, most of us want to go back to a simpler, healthier, and happier time. We can't. But we can still keep dreaming about how it once was. In my 20s, when I was a disc jockey, we used to play oldies. And people who called in to request those songs often commented that music used to be better than it is now. The reality is that in the old days, we played good and bad records, but the bad ones faded quickly from memory, just like the bad ones do now. No one ever asked us to play the music that bombed. The good songs made the former times seem great, as if all the music was outstanding. In reality, there was bad music 30 years ago, or 50 years ago. In fact, a lot of bad music. The same is true with experiences. We tend to forget the negative and go back to recapture pleasant times. The reality is, we have selectively remembered, and just as selectively, forgotten. Once that idea got through to me, I decided I couldn't recapture the past. No matter how much I tried to idealize it, that part of my life was over, and I would never be healthy or strong again. The only thing for me to do was to discover a new normal. Yes, I said to myself, there are things I will never be able to do again. I don't like that and may even hate it, but that doesn't change the way things are. The sooner I make peace with that fact and accept the way things are, the sooner I will be able to live in peace and enjoy my new normalcy. Here's an example of what I mean. In early 2000, I took a group of college kids on a ski trip from Houston to Colorado. Skiing is one of the things I always loved doing. Unable to participate, I sat in a clubhouse at the bottom of the hill, gazed out the window, and watched them glide down. Sadness came over me, and I thought, I've made a big mistake. I should never have come here. As happy as I was for them, I mourned over my inability ever to ski again. Then I thought for the thousandth time of the other things I would never do again. When I was a senior pastor, most of the adults greeted me at the door following each morning service. Enjoyed your sermon, they'd say. Great service. Kids, however, behaved differently. They'd race up with a picture they'd colored for me. Before my accident, I loved the kids flocking around me. I'd kneel down and talk to them. After my recovery, I couldn't squat down and stare at their smiling faces the way I used to before, as I said, thank you very much. I really like this picture. This is nice. After my accident, the best I could do was lean forward and talk to them. Perhaps that doesn't seem like a big thing, but it was for me. I'll never squat again. I'll never be able to kneel so that I can be at a child's level again, because my legs won't give me the ability to do that. Here's another example. When I go through a drive-through fast food restaurant, I can't reach for the change with my left arm. The best I can do is reach across my body with my right arm. It must look strange, and I get a few odd looks, but it's the best I can do. While neither of these examples is particularly dramatic, they are nonetheless reminders that sometimes things we take for granted every day can be taken from us permanently and suddenly, and we're changed forever. During my long hospitalization, somebody gave me a magazine article about a young man who lost his sight. He went through an incredibly bitter, depressive time. He wrote that he got so demoralized that a friend who cared enough about him to tell him the truth said, "You need to get past this." I paused from reading and thought, "Yes, that sounds like the way I was after my accident." The article went on, however, to tell the practical instructions the blind man's friend gave him. "I want you to make a list of all the stuff you can still do." Now, what kind of a list would that be? the angry blind man asked. Just do it for me. You can't write, obviously, but you can get a tape recorder and dictate it. Just make a list of all the things you can still do. And I'm talking about simple things like, I can still smell flowers. Make the list as extensive as you can. When you're finished, I want to hear that list. The blind man finally agreed and made the list. I don't know how much time passed, but when the friend returned, the blind man was smiling and peaceful. You seem like you're in a much better frame of mind than the last time I saw you, the friend said. I am. I really am. And that's because I've been working on my list. How many things are on your list? Oh, about 1,000 so far. That's fantastic. Some of them are very simple, and none of them are big, but there are thousands of things I can still do. The blind man had changed so radically that his friend asked, Tell me, what made you change? I've decided to do all the stuff I can. The more I thought about it, the fewer limitations I saw. There are thousands of things I can do, and I'm going to do them for the rest of my life. After I read that article, I thought, that's exactly what I need. Not mourning, pining, or going back over the way things used to be, or what I used to be.